Resources for Tuesday, April 24th, 2007. Open a public hearing on House Bill 5022 and House Bill 5023. Ms. Halleck, would you please begin at your leisure?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and with me today is Lisa Pearson from the Department of Administrative Services. And I have provided to you, in response to a request from the Legislative Fiscal Office yesterday, a one-pager describing the gaps, if you will, in DEQ's budget that I mentioned that had not been included in the governor's recommended budget. This was the hazardous waste program gap that I mentioned and the water quality standards program gap. And I also indicated at the top what the co-chairs had taken from the governor's rec. So the total of all three of those things is $7.6 million. And since I hadn't given you any paper on that yesterday, I thought it might be helpful to have that. With me also at the table, we're going to continue on with our performance measure discussion. We had left off, we were just going to start with performance measure number 10, and I've asked Greg Pettit, who is the administrator of our laboratory, to present this measure to you as it has to do with monitoring. And I know that there is a lot of interest in monitoring, and I thought there might be some questions. It would be helpful to have him here today.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Greg Pettit, and I'm the administrator of the DEQ Laboratory Division. As Stephanie mentioned, we're going to start off this morning talking about key performance measure number 10, which is on page 10 in Appendix B. And I've also handed out a map, which I'll be referring to during this discussion. Key performance measure number 10 has been tracked as a benchmark and is now proposed as a key performance measure. We'd like to spend a little more time on this performance measure, as it is one of the highest level environmental indicator measures in the state. It measures three components related to stream water quality: percentage of monitored stream sites with significantly increasing trends in water quality, percentage of sites with decreasing trends in water quality, and percentage of sites in good to excellent condition. Before we look in detail at the data for this performance measure, I would like to explain how this measure is calculated and what the data represents. These statistics are calculated based upon data collected from a network of ambient river monitoring sites across the state. The locations of these sites are shown on the ambient river monitoring network map that was just distributed. There are approximately 53,000 miles of perennial rivers and streams in Oregon. The ambient river monitoring network covers approximately 7,000 miles of the larger rivers and streams. Most major rivers and streams are represented, and larger rivers have multiple sites. For example, there are seven sites on the main stem of the Willamette. Other monitoring strategies are used to assess water quality in the smaller streams not represented in the ambient river monitoring network. There are 144 sites in the ambient river monitoring network in total. However, some of these sites, because of their remoteness, are not sampled frequently enough for statistically reliable trending analysis. The data for this measure is from 127 sites with adequate data for trending analysis. These are the sites displayed on the map. Not displayed on the map are 16 sites in southeastern Oregon that are only sampled twice per year. These sites provide excellent data to assess water quality trends, since some of these sites have been sampled consistently since the late 1940s. Most sites are sampled six times per year and some 12. To legitimately determine water quality trends and to ensure that you're not interpreting normal annual variability as a trend, you must have data regularly collected over a long period of time. DEQ uses data collected over the previous 10 years to calculate the trends. Water quality trends reported for 2006 reflect the trends from 1997 to 2006. Sites with improving trends are indicated on the map with an arrow pointing up, and sites with declining trends by the lightning symbol. We use the Oregon Water Quality Index as an overall indicator of general water quality. The Oregon Water Quality Index uses eight conventional indicators of water quality, including dissolved oxygen, solids, nutrients, and bacteria. The legend in the lower right-hand corner of the map indicates by color the status of each of these monitoring sites, ranging from very poor to excellent. and that's based upon the Oregon Water Quality Index score. The Oregon Water Quality Index has proven to be a very good indicator of both aesthetic conditions of water quality and biological aquatic community health. It is important to note, however, that the Oregon Water Quality Index does not include data about toxics such as pesticides or mercury. The most important thing to keep in mind with this measure is to compare the percentage of streams with improving trends to the percentage with declining trends. By doing this, we get a reliable overall determination if water quality is getting better or worse in Oregon. Our goal is, of course, to maintain and improve overall water quality. If you will look at the data for the year 2000, you will see that we had 70% of our sites with improving trends and only 1% with declining trends. The percentage of monitored Oregon stream sites with improving 10-year water quality trends significantly exceeded the number of sites with declining trends for trends reported from 1995 to 2004. However, for the years from 2000 to 2006, the percentage of streams with improving trends decreased, while the percentage of streams with declining trends increased. Remember, each of these years represents a trend for the preceding 10 years. In 2005, the number of sites with improving water quality trends equaled the number of sites with declining water quality trends. In the most recent analysis reflecting water quality trends from 1997 until 2006, 21% of the 127 sites had declining water quality trends, while 8% showed improving water quality trends. So why was water quality improving for the last 15 years and now it is not? Determining why there are trends is more difficult than determining what the trends are. Oftentimes it requires additional data that we do not have due to our limited monitoring resources. We know some of the reasons for trends with confidence. We have some unproven theories, and some are unknown. The biggest water quality improvements that we saw from 1990 through 2004, we can directly attribute it to the clean water management plans that were developed as part of our total maximum daily load, or TMDL, process. More specifically, where TMDLs resulted in more stringent treatment standards, and those standards were implemented, we could measure significant improvements in water quality as a result. Many of the early TMDLs, such as those on the Tualatin, Yamhill, Pudding, Bear Creek, and Columbia Slough, resulted in more stringent point source effluent requirements. However, during that same time, we were also seeing more modest water quality improvements in streams across the state where point sources did not occur or were not significant. We like to believe that such things as the President's Forest Plan, the Oregon Forest Practices Act, improved stormwater management, and an increased awareness of agricultural BMPs for water quality contributed to those improvements. If we look at the streams that currently have declining water quality, again, we know some of the reasons and some we do not. We have decreased water quality in several of the Tualatin sites we can attribute to the unintended consequences from a change in the treatment technology. Most of the streams sites with declining water quality trends are sites without significant point source impacts. Many of them are located on coastal streams. These trends may reflect weather-related changes in precipitation and temperature. The more recent TMDLs are mostly on streams where non-point sources are the primary concerns. The ability to reduce pollution from non-point sources is much more indirect and unsure than it is with point sources. Even if successful, the plans may take tens of years to show results. The targets for measures 79A and B are 75% of sites with improving trends and 5% with declining trends. That changed in the year 2006 to 0% with declining trends. Targets were established in the late 90s when 70% of the sites showed improving trends. The targets are arbitrary and based upon past performance. The important thing, again, is that the number of streams with improving trends should exceed those with declining trends. The number of sites rated good to excellent has increased from 27% in 1990 to 50% in 2006. The percent of sites in good to excellent condition exceeds the target of 40%. The 55% target starting in 2006 is being proposed but has not been adopted by the Progress Board. Across the state, Overall water quality based on the Oregon Water Quality Index has improved from 1990 to 2004. The biggest improvements can be traced to the implementation of the Clean Water Management Plans. This year, for the first time since 1990, we have seen the improving trend reversed, with more sites declining than improving. Overall water quality is still much improved from what it was. This is reflected in benchmark 79C, where 50% of the sites are in good to excellent condition, compared to 1990, when only 27% of the sites were in that category. But the trend is now going in the wrong direction. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you this morning, and I would be happy to answer any additional questions you may have.
I guess I could start off with a couple. First, it's a little bit difficult when you look at 79C and look where you have sort of gradual improvements in water quality and good to excellent condition in some of these areas. And then, obviously, you're showing a major decline in improving areas and a significant increase in decreasing or declining trend. So it's, without understanding the underlying data, it's hard to follow what that really means in the sense of how are you defining how are you defining the quality of the streams in terms of water quality? I assume you said that you're not addressing anything relative to toxics, so I assume probably one of those is temperature. But what are some of the other issues that you're looking at?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee. The Water Quality Index measures what we call conventional indicators of water quality, and that includes temperature, nutrients, bacteria, and things that cause a depressed dissolved oxygen. We measure biological oxygen demand, chemical oxygen demand. These traditionally were what the water quality program focused on in terms of setting effluent requirements for discharges. A lot of it was to clean up the effluent from sewage treatment facilities and from pulp mill waste and those things so that there was adequate oxygen in the water that it would support the fish life. And so those are the parameters that we measure with the Oregon Water Quality Index. And we've done a number of different studies where we've looked at the how good is the index in terms of how good is the correlation between the water quality index and the biological community in the stream. And we found it had a very high correlation to a healthy biological community within the stream. There are things that are not covered, primarily the toxics, and the reason why it does not include the toxics is we don't have adequate resources. Toxics monitoring and analysis is far more expensive than measuring these conventional pollutants, and that's one of the reasons why we have submitted a toxics proposal. But as far as the question about the improvements, it is confusing, I understand, and the simplest way I think I can explain it is a number of streams have improved to a certain level, and they're staying at that level. And so you don't see, we haven't seen a big number of streams declining for a long period of time. If the current trend of having more streams declining than improving kept up for a period of time, say 10 years, then we would expect to see that reflected in performance measure number 79C as well.
I'm just going to try and piggyback on you a little bit. If I have a stream that in 1990 is at this level, but by the year 2000 it's down to here, but you're cleaning it up, it shows a trend toward less pollution or stream quality, but yet overall it's not as good as it was 10 years ago. Yet it could have an arrow trending up, that it's improving. Am I connecting with you on this? But what I mean is the numbers are deceiving. It really doesn't tell you whether overall our water quality is improving statewide. It's an indication of, it's kind of like a snapshot of where things are just today. It's kind of like a balance sheet. It only shows you where we are right now. So I think trend is misleading.
Chair, Chairman Devlin and Representative Girard. The trending analysis, we use a statistical procedure for determining trends, and it's a statistical test that requires quite a bit of data. We use the data collected over a 10-year period of time to determine whether or not there's a water quality trend. Your point is a very good one, and this is exactly why we use a statistical test. We require a minimum of 30 data points collected over that 10-year period of time, and in most cases we have far more than that to analyze the trend. So for each year in that 10-year period, 1 year is compared to the preceding year, and we do that for year after year after year. And based upon that comparison, we determine if there's an overall water quality trend. So,
excuse me, but statistics only show you what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
What we should be concerned about is what's going to happen.
Would that be helpful, Representative Girard, to talk about where the targets come from, then looking prospectively?
Well, I think, again, that's going to weigh your trending. Depending upon the spots you pick, that will weigh the overall trending statewide. So you're in a sense controlling the statistical data just depending on where you sample it from.
I think actually, if I could respond to that, Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I think that is an excellent point. And we, as Greg mentioned, we do have 144 monitoring sites. That is by no means comprehensive. And so, and to your last point, I think that is absolutely correct, that depending on what's going on that water body where that monitoring site is, that's going to tell you something that may or may not be representative of other water bodies. And, you know, arguably, the way to fix that is to have a more broad monitoring network that gives you more sampling points. Just to not belabor this, but to go to your earlier point, the intent, I think the confusion in this measure personally, and I think the Progress Board did it, so we have to go back and discuss that with them, is 79C. I think when you look at 79A and B, it's pretty direct what we're saying here, and that we basically equalized at 14% in 2005. But then you get into measure 79C, and you try and explain how that relates to A and B, and I agree with you, I don't get it, so I don't know how anybody else would, but Greg does. That's why he's here. But I do think it's worth exploring with the Progress Board what the intent of C is, and is it really telling us anything. But the intent of A and B is, in fact, to show trends over time. Now, arguably, as you pointed out, if your monitoring points, you know, if they're the same ones, and let's say you have done work to improve that particular stream, and you're showing a trend at that monitoring point, you know, what I think your point is, what can you extrapolate appropriately from that data? And I think that's a very good question.
A couple more, but I just want to me, the C, I mean, at first, in a sense, it would seem like to be, in a sense, the most objective, because it's just simply telling you of the monitored stream sites how many are in good and excellent condition. But it would seem to me also that A and B, if you were to look at them in conjunction with C, would tell you that, A, you're probably not going to get much above the 50% level, and B, it might be declining in the future, given the direction that different areas are going. But the difficulty I have with this, in a sense, is understanding. It's almost like it's almost better to know the details than to mm-hmm. know the trends. Because I hate to use this example, but it's the easiest one for me to use. If I take 100 students, and they're all D students, and I improve all of them to B students, It looks like I've done an incredible job.
Which you probably have.
But if they all start to decline now back to C students, it looks like I've done terribly. But they're still better off than they were when I started.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of knowing where you start and where you end, the details under this actually, in a sense, gives you more information than... but I think this gives you I mean, if you looked at even not that you want to look at this graphically, but if you looked at this from year to year, in terms of even this depiction, you could probably see some of that, because you would see areas that were changing in terms of their designation from poor to fair to good or the reverse. But I don't know. I just think it's a little bit confusing. Representative Dingfelter wanted to add some clarity to the confusion.
Well, I'm going to try. And I appreciate Representative Gerard bringing up the confusion about this, because when I read it, I said, again, what is this really telling us? And I think that we need to keep in mind that there are a lot of excellent efforts to track on a watershed basis, and I'm sure you're all familiar with the report that OWEB puts out annually that looks at many parameters, including water quality, for watershed by watershed, because I think it's hard, even if within the Willamette, I mean, there's hundreds of sub-basins, but it's really hard for us to say statewide. I think, having a snapshot of areas around the state is sort of a better gauge of how we're doing, and OWEB is doing a lot of volunteer water quality monitoring that adds to the monitoring that BQ is doing. So I think we have a much better picture than what's reflected in this KPM. And certainly, maybe there's a way we can sort of look at, combining with the reporting that OWEB does to the legislature. I mean, I think that's a really excellent indicator, because it's not just looking only at water quality, but water quantity, which also has connections with water quality, and looking at temperature. They look at the whole range. But it's just hard to say, okay, how are we doing and are our programs working without looking on a watershed-by-watershed basis. And so I'd say that it is confusing. I'm not sure how valuable that is, but without going into a great amount of detail, like OWEB does in their annual report that shows watershed-by-watershed progress, it's hard to capture that, I think, in one or two KPMs. The other thing I thought about, and we ran out of time yesterday, but, we talk about TMDLs. And again, it's how many of TMDLs have been approved, but I think the proof is in the pudding of implementation of the TMDLs and really tracking how we're doing and meeting the goals. And I don't know if we want to think about maybe a KPM in the future that, since we've now adopted all the TMDLs, aren't we completed?
No, we're not, Representative Dingfelter, okay. But your point is a really good point. And Greg, when you were out of the room, alluded to the fact that the data now can tell us that on the streams that are improving, there is a correlation between streams where we have TMDLs, and maybe the conversation to have with the progress board, because this is a long-term progress board measure, so obviously we're going to have to go back and, if with your permission, communicate to them that the committee indicated there might be a better way to portray this information, but maybe that linkage is in the where we're doing TMDLs to make that more of a direct connection in the performance measure somehow.
Well, because, Mr. Chair, we're investing a lot of money in TMDL development and implementation, and the reason is because we're trying to improve water quality in those basins that have those limiting factors. So, it would be good to have a KPM that reflected those investments that we're making.
This is very helpful.
Chair Devlin, yes. Representative Dingfelter, I would like to comment is that we do work very closely with OWEB through the Oregon Plan Monitoring Team. And in fact, the monitoring section at DEQ provides technical support and equipment for the watershed councils that do water quality monitoring. And the Oregon Water Quality Index information here has been used in the annual reports, the OWEB reports that report on watershed conditions around the state. If I might just try a little bit to explain 79A and B a little bit better. This is a very confusing measure, and I apologize for that. And in fact, the reason it's confusing is because we went to a great deal of trouble to try to develop a measure that is scientifically defensible in terms of when we say there is a water quality trend. So for each one of the 144 sites that we have around the state, there's a statistical trending analysis based upon the data for that site that covers data collected over a 10-year period of time. Because there's a good deal of variability in water quality data from one time to the next, it's important that you use a scientifically defensible method before you say there's actually a water quality trend. So what this data reflects is the percentage for that whole network of 127 sites where we have adequate data for trending, this data reflects? What percentage of those sites showed an improving trend based upon the seasonal Kindle statistical test over a 10-year period of time versus what percentage of those sites showed a declining trend during that same period of time? A lot of times we're used to looking at the final results. We're used to looking at, say, the number of sites in the good to excellent category and that. And if you just plot that out, you can either see that going up or going down. And that's certainly more straightforward and I think an easier for us to understand than reporting a trend, because when a trend is going, when we do not have increasing sites anymore, it doesn't necessarily mean that things are getting worse. It can mean simply that they're staying better. But ultimately the goal here was we really wanted to know, are the water quality management programs working? Is water quality getting better, or is water quality getting worse? And that was the intent of these measures.
Along those lines, just one question out of curiosity. 79A, year 2000, which would be the trend for the previous 10 years to that, virtually 1991 to 2000, and you're showing 70% improvement in water quality trends. Any explanation? I mean, was water quality so bad at the early portion of that that, and we made efforts and it improved? Or, but that's an
yes. Oh, I can answer that. The Chair Devlin, the biggest trend, the biggest improvements we saw at sites across the strait, we could directly attribute to the clean water management plans that we developed as a result of the TMDLs. We also had improvements across the state, though, at lower levels in stream sites. And all of those improvements we can't fully explain. As I mentioned earlier, there were a number of new programs that dealt with non-point sources during that were just beginning to be implemented during the 90s, such things as the President's Forest Plan, a new Forest Practices Act, Senate Bill 1010 plans. And so we like to believe that all these things together helped improve water quality across the state during that time.
But on a 10-year basis, going back to 91, and 1010 only coming around 97 or 99, the only place where you would have had done quite a bit of TMDL work by that point would have been probably, I don't know if it was others, but the only one I'm aware of is the Tualatin River. And this is supposed to be looking broadly statewide.
Well, actually, the rivers that at that time showed improvements where we did have TMDLs done were the Tualatin, the Pudding River, the Yamhill River, Bear Creek. So there were Grand Ronde River. So there were a number of rivers where we had TMDLs done, and we saw water quality improvements.
And, Mr. Chair, one other thing I would add to that is the effectiveness of point source permitting controls. I mean, that if you look long-term, I mean, the Clean Water Act initially has focused on the regulation of point sources, municipal and industrial. And lots and lots and lots of money has been invested in that. And to your point about was it so bad before, yes. I mean, we've all heard stories about how the Willamette River used to be. And so the effectiveness over time of those permitting programs, there's no question that that has made a huge difference.
I'm not going to refute your claims to how much you have achieved, but just to remind the committee that everything, all the data we see are based on scientific data, and the scientific data itself is at times questionable.
And that's correct, Representative Girard. And I guess I know you want to move on. The other observation that I would make is you've heard many times from many people, including me, about the inadequacy of the monitoring programs at DEQ. And we're having a conversation about that. And last year at Senator Bates' request, he said how much money would it cost. He asked me to work with my laboratory staff on how much would it cost to have a fully comprehensive water quality monitoring program for the state of Oregon. And it would cost about $33 million. which is obviously $33 million that we don't have. So we do the best with what we have, which in this budget cycle includes a $2 million request in the governor's recommended budget to enhance water quality toxic monitoring on top of the program we have now. And I will be the first to say that it is not comprehensive, and it is the best that we can do given the resources that we have.
Representative Rod, then Representative Klein, and then
comment.
Move on.
Director Halleck, you're absolutely right, and that's exactly what we need to do. And I'll work on Chair Devlin to see if he's got $33 million in his back pocket. Probably won't work very well, but you hit the nail right on the head. Thank you.
On that number, $33 million, was the FTE increase up to 80 from 18 now in water quality monitoring to 80? Is that what the $33 million buys? I read that somewhere a while ago. What the needed number of human beings to do it would be.
I can get it for you, Representative Clem. I don't remember the exact. I've got the whole memo and everything that we prepared for Senator Bates. I'd be happy to get a copy for the committee and give it to you, unless Greg remembers off the top of his head.
I believe I do. I think Chair Devlin, Representative Clem, right now we have 18 people in our monitoring section. That does not include analytical staff and support staff. In total, we have in our budget 37 FTE. When you include all the supports positions for water quality monitoring. By comparison, the state of Washington has approximately 115 FTE to do the same function as we do with 37 FTE. 115.
That depends on how much water you have.
Actually, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I realized where I read it. It's back on page 37, there's a discussion of what needs to be done, and it talks about the network of ambient monitoring sites. The Progress Board is recommending supplementing this with additional. DEQ has developed a comprehensive water. To do this, we need to go, we would need more than 80 staff currently. And so that kind of explains everything we've been talking about. Actually, if I would have read my book a little earlier, I would have remembered that.
Thank you, Representative Clem. And the only clarification I would make, because I know the subject of staff is always sensitive, that the monitoring program we're talking about doesn't include just staff. It includes a lot more monitoring sites.
Let's go on to 11.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Moving on to performance measure 11, I'm going to invite Karen Whistler back to the table. She spoke to you yesterday. She is the person who is puts together our performance measure reports.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Karen Whistler, and I'm DEQ's performance measures coordinator. And picking up with performance measure number 11, on page 11, this is a new key performance measure that will track diesel particulate emissions. Diesel exhaust ranks among the top toxic air pollutants in Oregon, exceeding the health benchmarks in 25 of Oregon's 36 counties. Oregonians have an overall cancer risk from diesel exhaust that's roughly 13 times the public benchmark, and this is set by the Environmental Quality Commission. To meet the health benchmark, we must reduce diesel emissions from our target of 3,200 tons in 2008 to 250 tons in 2017. You'll notice that we've provided data on this table that establishes a baseline of what our current emissions are for diesel. The emissions inventory is conducted every 3 years, and diesel emission data for 2005 will be available at the end of this year. Recent federal regulations require new diesel engines to have very low emissions, but they don't require emissions reductions from the large number of existing diesel engines. Diesel engines turn over slowly because they're very durable, so by 2017, the federal program will only provide for about half of the needed emissions reductions to reach the target. House Bill 2172 supports our diesel initiative by providing grants, loans, and tax credits to encourage diesel engine owners to retrofit existing diesel engines with emissions controls, to rebuild or replace older diesel engines, and to reduce diesel idling. The governor's recommended budget includes $3 million in Policy Package 119 to fund House Bill 2172 and make progress towards meeting this important public health measure.
I just thought, what does the governor or the co-chair's budget do?
Provides for $1 million in DEQ's budget. I actually believe there's about a million somewhere else. Not clearly identified, and then there's some expectation of federal funds. A question. Senator Nelson, did you have anything additional? From some of your previous reports on diesel, obviously part of the issue is our large diesel trucks. But you pointed out before in some of your reports that one of your biggest areas of emissions with diesel is like large heavy equipment that operates sometimes for relatively short periods of time, but has significant emissions, such things as cranes and bulldozers. And would the program apply to them also?
Mr. Chair, I can have Andy Ginsberg talk right now in some detail about this program, although he's coming up when we're finished with performance measures and was going to get into that then. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Just curious. Anything additional? Okay, 12.
Great. Key performance measure number 12 on page 11 is an existing Oregon benchmark. It's benchmark number 75. This has been our primary measure of air quality in Oregon for many years. We're proposing to adopt this benchmark as an agency key performance measure. The benchmark tracks whether Oregon's air quality meets federal air quality health standards that are set by EPA. This measure was recently revised by working with the Progress Board to better reflect today's air quality conditions. The data for the old version of the measure is in the Annual Performance Progress Report, which is located at Tab B, Appendix 1, on page 33. In the 1970s and the 1980s, many Oregon communities routinely violated federal standards for carbon monoxide, ozone, and particulate matter. Thanks to a variety of federal, state, and local reduction strategies, all areas of the state were meeting federal standards by the mid-1990s. However, there are still numerous individual days when the air is unhealthy to breathe, particularly for sensitive groups such as children, the elderly, and the health impaired. More significantly, EPA tightened the standards for fine particulate matter in late 2006, based on the most recent health studies. Now, Oregon has two communities, Klamath Falls and Oak Ridge, which are once again violating federal standards, and a dozen other communities are at risk from elevated particulate levels. The 2006 unhealthy air days are preliminary numbers, but clearly show the impact of the standard change. EPA has also begun a review of the ozone standard, and early indications are that they will tighten this standard as well within the next few years. The targets for unhealthy air days from 2007 to 2009 are driven by EPA's new fine particulate standard. Our target for the longer term is to eliminate unhealthy air days and return Oregon to compliance with federal standards. Policy Package 110 provides the monitoring and technical resources needed to achieve this target. Excuse me.
Questions? Representative Clem.
I have a question on the air quality conditions. I've been in a variety of discussions in the newspapers about agricultural burning.
DEQ currently doesn't participate in monitoring that, or is that all part of these same factors, same calculations?
Representative Clem, Mr. Chairman, the Oregon Department of Agriculture is the state agency that actually regulates and runs the fuel burning program. And we obviously work closely with them. We do get monitoring data. The particulate standard that Karen referred to, that pollutant is the pollutant of concern with burning, is particulate matter. So in areas where she mentioned that Klamath Falls and Oak Ridge are at risk now, immediately at risk. Historically, fuel burning for those communities was not the major consideration. Klamath Falls, I think it was wood stoves. There were some others. But that the times when there is burning, the monitoring data would pick up the particulate from that burning. And also, I think in Klamath Falls, flash burning is maybe an issue as well, and the monitors would pick up the particulate from that as well.
So, well, if I
So it's fair to say that the studying that Oregon is doing, or the monitoring Oregon's doing, is already inclusive of that activity. But the regulatory side of that is not something, I mean, you know, the complaint, I think, from the critics of field burning is that you know, there seem to be any existing framework for doing anything about it if it exceeds an area. And I guess that's my question. Is that really true that, yes, we monitor it, but there's nothing, you know, that is done about it from the state side?
The one of the particular areas of concern, Representative Clem, is the Eugene Springfield area. And I neglected to mention that there is another entity involved in this, and that's the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority. That is the only area of the state where we actually have a local authority. And they as well play a role in working with the Department of Agriculture for that area. And the idea is through the meteorological data and the other scientific methods that are used to determine when it is a good idea to burn because of the weather conditions. And so there is control over when that happens and when it is supposed to happen versus when it should not happen. It clearly has not always been a perfect system, hence the complaints. There is supposed to be complaint response from the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority. We do occasionally get calls, and we do refer folks to the Department of Agriculture when we get those calls. And Andy, do they fine for that? I don't know whether there are penalties for field burning or not. And Andy can talk more about when he comes up or answer that question now. Whatever. Okay. We'll check and find out whether or not the Department of Ag actually issues any penalties for that. But there is a system in place to control the burning. It's not as if people can just burn when they want or anything like that.
Representative Vaughn.
When you place a monitor in the community and you're measuring particulates 10 and 2, does that one device give you the particulates for both of those, or just one?
My understanding, Representative Girard, is that we will have monitoring equipment. Now, since the standard has just changed, I'm not sure whether we have to make some change outs in our monitoring equipment, but when Andy comes up, he can answer that directly. But we ought to be able to measure for both, and I don't know whether that happens with the same equipment.
Follow? This is one of my big gripes. And we went through it even when I was a county commissioner in Klamath in the late 1990s, is that we were held out of compliance for a particular particulate, but there was no monitoring device that could measure that. And so I think we were fairly right in saying, how are you saying we're out of compliance when you can't measure us? So anyway, that question still looms in the back of my mind.
Understandably. And when Andy comes up to talk about air, I will ask him to talk a little bit about the new standard and how we intend to figure out compliance in the state with the new standard and if our monitoring equipment is able to do that.
Let's go on to the next.
Okay, so moving on to key performance measure number 13, which is on page 12 in your binder. This is a new benchmark, which was adopted by the Oregon Progress Board to measure risk from toxic air pollutants. In combination with Key Performance Measure 12, which I just talked about, this measure will provide a more complete picture of the quality of Oregon's air and its impact on Oregonians. The measure considers the risk of cancer and other health effects from toxic air pollutants like benzene, diesel, exhaust, and toxic combustion byproducts. Most Oregonians are exposed to one or more toxic air pollutants above health benchmarks set by the Environmental Quality Commission. And reducing this risk will require a sustained effort over decades, similar to the successful efforts that we had in meeting standards for carbon monoxide and smog during the 1980s and 1990s. Progress along the way will be measured using periodic exposure assessments conducted by EPA, supplemented with monitoring conducted by DEQ. As an example, benzene concentrations exceed health benchmarks in 34 of Oregon's 36 counties. New federal rules to reduce the amount of benzene in gasoline will reduce the risk of leukemia in 2012 and beyond. Additional state efforts will be needed to reduce benzene from motor vehicles, fuel distribution, and burning. These efforts will gradually reduce the risk of cancer to Oregonians, even though it will take time to reach the health benchmarks throughout the state. Policy packages associated with Key Performance Measure 13 include number 111, which provides resources to monitor and reduce health risks from toxic air pollution, number 119, which reduces health risks from diesel engines, and number 112 and 113, which reduce toxic air pollution from industrial sources. Current resources for monitoring and reducing toxic air pollutants are limited, and without these packages, DEQ will not make progress towards reducing toxic air pollution.
In terms of toxic air pollutants that contribute to cancer, is that going to be, well, it's probably not possible. Is that a static definition of what those pollutants are and at what levels? Because I think there's some things that there always will be traces of in the environment regardless of what you do. I mean...
Well, as our understanding of science increases, certainly the levels at which we establish carcinogenic effects also improves in terms of our understanding. What I can tell you is that the top five carcinogens in Oregon are benzene, chromium 6, diesel particulate, ethylene dibromide, and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Does that get at your question?
But there are standards, are there not, that what you would consider... well, at least for some of those, where if you were trying to measure this, you might be able to decrease the trace amount, but you wouldn't be able to eliminate it completely. So at what point are you saying that it's that they're no longer exposed, or that they're not exposed at a level that can contribute? And obviously that's in debate, because there's always a debate between whether federal standards are adequate.
Mr. Chair, I think in a way you just answered your own question, and as a good example, mercury.
Yeah.
I mean, as we discussed yesterday, I mean, there is mercury in the environment, and I think one of the challenges, and Andy, when he comes up, can talk a little bit about how the federal government established their baselines for toxics. But it is important that a baseline get established so that you know where you're measuring from. I'm not familiar with them in terms of the federal EPA. I do know that our own commission has established benchmarks by rule, and Andy can talk a bit about those as well. So we have attempted to do that and, in fact, acknowledge that for some of these, and I don't know which on Karen's list, but mercury, I do know, for example, already do exist in the environment to a certain extent. Arsenic is another one that does exist naturally in the environment. And so clearly you have to figure out what contribution. And just as an aside, in water quality, when we do a total maximum daily load, one of the ways we get at that issue is part of the load is what's natural, is figuring that out, which is another reason it's very, very hard and complicated to do. But we'll talk more about that when we get to the air program. We can give you as much detail on these things as you want.
Additional questions? Item 14.
Okay. Key performance measure number 15.
14, we have
13. So it's on page 12. And this is the ERT measure. It was established as a statewide measure to track customer service related to the governor's economic revitalization team. ERT was established during a time of economic recession and budgetary crisis in the state. Its efforts are intended to provide coordinated assistance to local governments and businesses to promote economic development within the state. ERT projects, as you know, can be highly challenging as a result of the need to coordinate competing program goals across several agencies.
Mr. Chair, what does ERT stand for?
The Economic Revitalization Team, Representative Farage.
We should spell that out in the measure.
Okay. The governor's ERT staff actually conducts the survey to measure progress by agencies. Results for the measure were not included in the 2005 report. However, we do have it provided for you here. And the partner agencies involved in the governor's ERT team worked together to develop the measure. The survey results are that for DEQ, 74.4% of the respondents ranked DEQ involvement as good to excellent. We've established a target of 80% of our ERT customers rating DEQ involvement as good to excellent for the 2007-09 biennium. Any questions on that?
Seeing none, we'll go on to 15.
Okay. Key performance measure number 15, which is behind a whole bunch of pages here. He's on page 13. It's a new measure that tracks DEQ timeliness in issuing air quality operating permits. To
no, we have boards and commissions.
Oh, my goodness. Sorry.
You don't even actually have to cover
it. You don't have to.
Boards and commission, it's a new requirement.
Okay. We can
see we know
that.
What it is. It's
great.
In every...
The committee's right. Seen it a lot. So
yeah,
far.
So we can go to 16.
Okay. So 16...
It is our
last measure for this biennium. It's a new measure, and it tracks DEQ timeliness in issuing air quality operating permits to Oregon's largest industrial facilities. These are facilities that are regulated under the Federal Clean Water Act, Title V. This measure supports our strategic priority of protecting air quality and complements key performance measure number 2, which was also a benchmark number 10A, which measures permit timeliness related to air quality operating permits for medium-sized facilities and construction. We've been tracking timeliness in the Title V permitting program less formally for several years. We established an internal target of issuing 90% of our Title V permits within the target period. We've not yet met this timeliness target and have been progressively dipping below the target due to being short-staffed. In addition to slower permitting, now 25% of our Title V permits are expired. Revenue shortfalls have meant reducing staffing that has directly impacted our Title V permit timeliness. Over the last 4 years, permit timeliness has fallen from 84% to just over 50%. Without the resources requested by Senate Bill 107 and Policy Package Number 112, companies requiring operational changes that are not allowed under their existing permits will experience further delays in obtaining their permit, and our timeliness performance will drop additionally.
Alec, why don't you comment just briefly, even though the fee is not before us right now, and I know it's the S-107 that was indicated, in Title V, it has to be all fee-based.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And I actually requested of my staff that we add this performance measure for Title V because we have an earlier performance measure that is for the state air permitting. But Title V refers to Title V of the Clean Air Act. It is a delegated federal permitting authority by EPA to us. And when Congress enacted it, they said that it must be supported by fees. The federal government was not going to pay to support this permitting program. So that's why we have Senate Bill 107. We do have a consumer price index inflationary factor in the statute. It has not kept up, as I alluded to earlier in my testimony, that the CPI has overall not kept up with the cost of personnel and health care, and so we're asking for a fee increase in Senate Bill 107.
I just wanted to get it on the record that at the beginning of this session, I understand that there was some disagreement with stakeholders on this fee, but those have been resolved now, and my understanding is there is no opposition to the fee increase.
That is correct. Mr. Chair, my understanding is that amendments are being drafted with a revised fee schedule and also a phase-in for the fees that is agreeable to the two industry groups that were objecting to the fee.
Mr. Chair, we had a hearing the day you were gone, so we heard that the concerns and that there is an amendment being drafted or already drafted that will be back on Thursday.
Any additional questions, comments? Next up, why don't we go very quickly through the deletions?
Happy to do that.
Okay. We propose to delete 6 of our 2005 performance measures that are no longer relevant for a variety of reasons, including that we've completed the work that was measured by the measure, or that we found the measure to be duplicative, or that we found a better way to measure our performance. So I'm happy to go through those briefly. And the numbering of these measures reflects how they were in 2005, so I'm hoping that wouldn't be too confusing for you. Old key performance measure number 1, which measured our progress in completing DEQ's enforcement rule revision, and we completed that in 2005 with a new set of enforcement rules and policies. We're working on a new measure that will indicate if we are achieving our goal of clear, equitable, and efficient enforcement of environmental laws and regulations. old key performance measure number 4 is the measure of the total amount of TMDLs that are completed according to the 2000 EPA consent decree. We propose to delete this measure because it's essentially duplicative of key performance measure number 5 included in this biennium, which measures the total percent of water bodies for which a TMDL has been prepared. So this is essentially a subset of those. Key performance measure number 6, the percent of individual permits that are developed on a watershed basis. We propose to delete this measure because watershed permitting is an internal administrative strategy. We believe this strategy will result in improved coordination of agency water quality improvement efforts, and we will continue to report on our watershed-based permits as part of our annual reports to EQC pursuant to the 2005 amendments adopted by the legislature. Key performance measure number 8 is the percent of permitted facilities that produce reclaimed water for use. Did you want me to stop at some point?
No, no. I'm just waiting. Okay. We'll go to questions.
This program is part of the agency's strategic directions and part of the permit program improvements that were recommended by the Blue Ribbon Committee, as well as the governor's executive order to DEQ and other agencies. We will continue to encourage efforts by permitted wastewater treatment facilities to reclaim water for use. However, we don't believe that we need to track this as an agency key performance measure. Instead, we will continue to monitor our progress as part of our other work. Old key performance measure number 12 is the cumulative number of abandoned mines assessed for toxic contaminants. We adopted a strategy in 2002 to make these sites the priority for cleanup. Since that time, we've completed the assessment of sites that pose the greatest risk to human health and the environment, and so we're proposing to delete this measure. We will continue to review sites that should be added to the cleanup priority list on an annual basis, and we will also continue to track our progress in cleanups through key performance measure number 7, which measures the percent of all identified hazardous waste sites cleaned up. And finally, key performance measure number 13, which tracks the average number of page views per month. This was adopted as a part of our effort to measure excellence in customer service. However, the measure has been problematic since its inception. The web page hits measure does not tell us anything about how accessible environmental information is to Oregonians. It also doesn't really tell us how many people are accessing our pages, since internal DEQ employees are also counted in those web page hits. It also doesn't tell us anything about the perceived quality of our DEQ web pages. So, that is it in terms of the measures that we're proposing not to move forward with in the next biennium.
Any questions? Okay, seeing none. I did have one question on the abandoned mines. Do you have any publication that you have put out in recent years that would be sort of an examination of your work in that area? I mean, a compilation?
Mr. Chair, we do an annual cleanup report that we provide to this body, and I'll be happy to look in there and see if abandoned mines is specifically addressed. I suspect that it's a subset. We also have put out, which I will get to you, individual fact sheets on significant abandoned mine cleanups, Formosa Mine, Black Butte Mine, some of the other mines that we have been predominantly involved in. We have specific fact sheets on those. Okay. But if there's something particular you're looking for, just let me know and we'll see if we've got it.
Okay. I don't know if the committee would want it all, but I would be interested in whatever you could provide.
Okay. I'd be happy to do
that. If other members want to make specific requests, I think that would be better rather than providing them all that paper. They they probably do not want any more paper in their offices, or particular staff does not want any more paper in their offices. At this particular juncture, we could go on for about 15 more minutes. What would be the best use of that time right now?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would suggest that Andy come to the table, Andy Ginsberg, my air quality administrator. I think Representative Klim had one of the questions, but he could respond to some of the questions that were asked and just maybe do a piece of his overview so we could get started on the air program, if that's okay with you.
That should be fine.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Karen.
Again, this is Andy Ginsberg joining me at the table. He's the administrator of the Air Quality Division at DEQ.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andy Ginsberg, Air Quality Administrator at DEQ. And I guess I could start with just responding to questions about monitoring. We actually have different monitors for PM 2.5 and PM 10, and the difference between those pollutants is the size of them. So you need a different monitor that will capture the smaller, filter out the larger particles or the smaller particles. And EPA has standards for monitoring. They're called federal reference monitors. And so only those monitors that meet EPA's federal reference monitoring methods can be used to designate an area as attainment or non-attainment. But we also have other types of monitors, and maybe this gets at what Representative Garrard was saying, that we can use to estimate emission levels. What they do is measure light scattering. Rather than actually measuring the amount of particles in the air, it shoots a beam of light and measures the scattering, and we can correlate that to the level of particulate in the air and estimate. But we can't use that data formally to declare an area meeting or not meeting the standards. That type of monitoring is a lot less expensive, and it's continuous. Instead of with a normal federal reference monitor, we actually have to send a personnel to pick up a filter, bring it back to the lab, and weigh it under very carefully controlled conditions. With the light scattering monitor, we can have it in the field. It can transmit data to us, and we can get real-time information. So they're for different purposes, but they are very different monitors. Does that answer the question?
He probably wants to know what's in his area.
Just to follow up, Andy, where you place those monitors is of a great significance, that are measuring the light infractions, et cetera. I mean, if you place one out in farmland when you know somebody's going to be out there turning the ground over, you're going to get a lot of dust, and it might reflect the whole area is out of containment. But that isn't the case. And so much of your data is challengeable from those standpoints in that, I mean, this sounds like I'm being critical of this agency, and I'm not. I'm really trying. You've been cut for so long that you're trying to comply with these federal regulations and do it the best way you can. And what I'm saying is that I believe because of that, your scientific data is questionable because you've had to cut corners so often. I don't know whether you agree with that or not.
Well, if I just may for a moment, Senator Devlin and Representative Garrard, with the new federal particulate standard coming in and the amount of work that has gone on in this state, notably your community, to comply with the old standard, it is very important to us that what is asked of the communities who will now be out of attainment, theoretically, with the new standard, that we ask actions that are appropriate to the situation. And what I would like to do is have Andy's staff put together for you and any of the other legislators whose districts are affected what the plan is, where the monitors are going to be, will we have adequate monitors, what the problems are, and if there is a question of our ability to do that because of the budget situation we're in right now in AIR, we'll advise you of that as well. So, you know, I guess what I'm trying to do is assure you that to the best of our ability, we take it very seriously that you worked very, very hard to come into attainment, and now we have a standard that in theory says you're going to be out of attainment again, and that we are responsible to provide to you the best we can a good monitoring network and some reliable data. And so I will ask Andy to get you the specifics, and we can see if we're going to be able to do that. And if we're not, we'll talk about that as well.
That would be most appropriate, and I thank you, Madam Director. The committee has to, and I think does understand how this affects your community top to bottom, whether it be economic development, because it can stop your economic development dead in its tracks. It can stop growth if that's what you want it to do. Your community is completely vulnerable to these air quality regulations. And while nobody's challenging that maybe one particle is more dangerous than another, to make sure that we have the correct scientific data. And we in the climate basin sometimes have a tendency to turn our back on scientific data because it has been proven incorrect so often. So forgive us for that. Forgive me for that suspicion. But I would look forward to that information, and I think it's most appropriate, and I thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, we will definitely put that information together for you. And you're absolutely right that when an area violates federal air quality standards, the way the Clean Air Act is set up, it specifically sanctions growth in those areas. It makes it harder to locate highways. It makes it harder to attract new businesses because the regulations are more stringent. And that's why the communities are always very anxious to work with us to come back into attainment. And monitoring really is the key. When we look around the state, we use various techniques to identify places where we're likely to have a problem. Then we typically go in and do what we call a monitoring survey, where we put out a large number of monitors all around the community to identify, first, are we over the standard, and second, where are the highest levels of pollution measured. Then, under normal conditions, when we have adequate funding, we'll put a couple of monitors at the high points, and we'll also put background monitors so we know what's coming into the community, and we measure for a long period of time. In all of our areas in Oregon, since up until EPA recently tightened the standard, we were meeting the standards. We actually started reducing our monitoring network. We lost state funds and we lost federal funds, and so now we have pretty much a skeleton network where we just have one or two monitors left behind in communities. And on that basis, we're having to make new designations. And so you're absolutely right; monitoring is the key. And when I get to talking about our policy packages, I'll talk about that more as well.
One question that I had, on the particulate, I believe that was the performance measure back here where the standard had changed. This is getting into the policy side, but it's almost unavoidable. The federal government develops a new standard that puts a lot of areas out of compliance. How long of a timeline does the federal government give in this particular case to come into compliance before taking any of those sanctions or putting on any of those restrictions?
Mr. Chair, because the fine particulate standard already existed and what they did was tighten it, we already had a network of monitoring around the country, so EPA assumed that we would be able to fairly quickly make the call, is an area meeting it or not. They gave us 1 year to do that from the date of promulgation of the standard. Then we get 18 months for those areas that are violating the standard, we get 18 months to put together an attainment plan to bring the area back into compliance. And the plan is allowed to take up to 3 years to meet the standard. So when you add it all up, we get about 4 or 5 years from the point when the standard changes until we have to be meeting the new standard. Sometimes that can be longer. If they come out with a whole new standard for a whole new pollutant, they'll give us extra time to put a monitoring network on the ground. But in this case, because it's the same pollutant, just a tighter standard, they move pretty quickly.
Why don't we see if we can do a couple of the budget drivers, and then we'll end up for today. Finish today.
Okay. If you could turn to tab C in your white binder. And I'd like to start on page one, if I could, just to give a little bit of an overview for air quality. And this page shows our successes and challenges, and it's pretty relevant to what we were just talking about. The success on the left side, if you look at that map, you'll see all of the areas in the state that at one time or another have violated federal air quality standards. And those standards are set to protect public health. These are standards to prevent illnesses like asthma and bronchitis, heart disease. And back in the 1970s and the 1980s, we violated federal standards in 9 communities that you can see on the map for 1 to 3 pollutants, carbon monoxide, particulate matter, and ozone. In fact, back in 1977, when the Clean Air Act was amended, we monitored typically in a year 350 exceedances of one of those federal air quality standards each year in Oregon. And Klamath Falls, since we were just talking about Klamath Falls, had the distinction of having the worst air quality in the nation for particulate matter back in 1977. We used the classic performance management approach to solving this problem. We started out deploying a monitoring network so we could identify what the air quality levels were, and to measure the meteorology, which is so important in air quality, the wind direction, mixing heights, and things like that. We put together a comprehensive inventory of emissions so we can know where the emissions are coming from. We developed dispersion models so that we could determine if we reduced emissions, how much would it improve air quality. We worked with local advisory committees to put together air quality improvement plans where we identified specific measures that would go into place that would work for those communities. And then we adopted and implemented those measures and monitored progress along the way, both with our monitoring network and also with our emission inventory, tracking the changes. And the net result is all of the areas that you see on the left side of page one are now, well, came into attainment with the standards up until EPA just changed the standard this year. And that was really a tremendous success for us because over that same period we had a high amount of population growth in the state. So that was an investment we made in clean air. It pays off not only in improved air quality, but also in lower health care costs because these pollutants are set to protect public health. And as Representative Garrard mentioned, also pays off in terms of economic development because those areas face pretty significant sanctions to growth when they're not meeting the standards. We had a number of other successes that are not shown in this chart, but I'll just mention briefly. We had we developed one of the first vehicle inspection programs in the country to develop to fight carbon monoxide and smog. We developed the certified wood stove program right here in Oregon to reduce emissions from new wood stoves. And the program was so successful it was picked up nationally, and now all new wood stoves sold in the country have to meet standards that were originally developed in Oregon. And we were also the first state in the nation to issue all of the Title V permits under the Federal Clean Air Act amendments of 1990. And we regularly receive praise from the regulated community about how we implement that program with good customer service. So we have a very well-run program, and we also work, as Stephanie mentioned, with the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency. It's our only local air quality agency in Oregon that's responsible for air quality in Lane County. So we've made significant gains, but we have even bigger challenges ahead, and those are shown on the right-hand side of page one. And I'll just run through those really briefly. The first challenge, illustrated by the wood stove there, fine particulate. As we've been discussing, EPA has recently tightened the standard for fine particulate. And as we mentioned, Klamath Falls and Oak Ridge are violating the new standard. We're also concerned about health impacts in nearly a dozen other Oregon communities that are not violating the standard right now. Some of them are right on the edge and could go into violation. Others are well below the standard but still above levels that the scientists tell us are of concern for health from a health perspective. Also, EPA has announced that they are reviewing the ozone standard or the smog standard, and based on the preliminary information they've put out so far, it looks very likely that they will tighten that standard also, and that could send us back into non-attainment in some areas of the state for ozone. So later in my presentation, I'll be talking about the policy packages that we have to address the federal health standards. The second challenge is diesel and other toxic air pollutants, such as benzene, that you may have heard about in the news recently. These are pollutants, as Karen mentioned, that cause cancer and other serious health effects. And also, as Karen mentioned, every county in Oregon has one or more of these pollutants over health benchmarks set by the Environmental Quality Commission. And also to address one of the other questions that was raised earlier by the chair, we do set specific standards for each pollutant, and we only set benchmarks for pollutants that are of concern or emitted at high enough levels in Oregon. But these benchmarks are set with the assistance of a science advisory committee through a very deliberative process that took over a year. And they're set for each pollutant, and they're reviewed regularly so that as we get new scientific information, we'll set a new health benchmark.
Yeah. I have a question for Andy about the benzene. standard, and when, first of all, the federal standards going to go into effect, the change that would actually lower benzene levels here in the Northwest, and two, is that the major source of benzene? It's coming from gasoline, from transportation sources.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkfelder, gasoline is the largest source of benzene, and it's not the only source, as we've discussed in your committee, but it is the largest source. And the gasoline in Oregon has among the highest benzene levels in the country, and that's because crude oil from Alaska is naturally higher in benzene than other parts of the country. It's also because the refining process here doesn't take the benzene out. There's no market. There's no chemical industry that would utilize benzene, so there's no incentive for them to take the benzene actually out of the gasoline before it's sold. EPA has recently adopted new requirements for all refineries in the nation to lower their benzene levels. Oregon was an active participant in that, and Representative Dingfelder's committee kind of spearheaded the effort for the legislature to comment to EPA and urge them to adopt a rule that would protect the Northwest, because initially their proposal allowed state refineries to average their benzene emissions from one refinery to another, and the way EPA assessed the economics, it looked like we weren't going to get very much reduction here, or we would still be left in the Northwest with the highest benzene levels in the country. So based on the input from the Oregon legislature, as well as Senator Wyden and others, EPA revised their rule, and based on the revision, we are going to get benzene levels here that are comparable to the rest of the country. So that was a really big success. We won't see the benefits right away. the standard will go into effect in 2012, and smaller refineries get a little extra time to comply, so it may be 2013 until we actually see lower benzene levels on the ground here.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson, that'll be your final question.
Is the benzene from the driving of the cars, or is it from the refinery?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, the benzene is all up and down the fuel distribution and use cycle. Most of the emissions here in Oregon would be from the driving of the car, since we have no refineries in Oregon, but it also comes from emissions from the bulk storage tanks in Portland and Eugene and a few other places. It comes from the transfer of gasoline from the tanks to trucks and barges. It comes from filling the underground storage tanks at gasoline stations. It comes from fueling of motor vehicles, all up and down the chain. Most of it, though, comes from the tailpipe of the cars.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say thank you to Andy, because Andy and the DT staff were very, very helpful. We had it was a bipartisan and bicameral effort, because Senator Avakian of the committee and I both co-signed the letter, and we really appreciate that. And I think that's a huge victory, because that means less money we're going to have to spend here in Oregon to prevent or reduce or remove that benzene that we didn't have a lot of control over in the first place. So I think that's a classic example of how we actually can influence federal regulatory process. And I was really very pleased, and you know, want to thank the DQ staff for their hard work.
At this particular juncture, why don't we stop? And tomorrow, if you want to just briefly go over where you've gone in challenges and then hit some other things that you didn't have a chance to get to there, that would be good. And then we'll get into the actual the rest of your presentation. So we'll start again at 8:30 tomorrow, and I will close both public hearings and adjourn the 8:30 tomorrow.